Mantis. Robert Reed. Infinity windows were installed 2 months ago, but technical troubles, nebulous and vexing, delayed their coming online. The tall squid-skin sheets were left transparent, revealing white walls and assorted cables leading back to the building's servers and power plant. Mr. Pembroke is our club manager, and whenever he bounced past, he made the point of apologizing for any inconvenience. But I didn't particularly miss the mirrors that used to hang here. Staring at my pained, sweat-sheened face was never an attraction. And I didn't pine for the giant televisions tuned to sports I didn't follow and the 24/7 crime networks. White and bland suited my task, and after the first week, it felt as if this was the way it had always been. My club sits 10 stories above the apartment where I live with my son. 50 machines of various designs fill a long, narrow, well-ventilated room. My favorite machine is near the back corner, and it's usually unoccupied in the early afternoon. As a rule, I avoid the newer models. I'm avid, but lazy, and their miles feel long to me. I know what to expect when I work the pedals and swing the long arms, the onboard computer interfacing with a heart and lungs it knows as well as any. I prefer hill workouts while watching history programs from my own library, and one hard hour is usually enough to cleanse a brain evolved to chase antelope across a grassy plain. Mostly, the same faces haunt the club every day, and we know each other on sight and sometimes by name. A few regulars are passing acquaintances. Not Barry. I know her name only because someone once called her that in front of me. Barry might be her first name, or last, or a nickname. Or I didn't hear things right, and she's somebody else entirely. Whatever the name, the woman seems to be in her late 60s. She has a long face framed with hair dyed a luxurious, unnatural black. She never asks anything of her machine except a lot of easy minutes. She watches old hospital shows, turn-of-the-century stuff. Like me, she has her favorite machine or two, and she always wears the big smile of somebody who is relentlessly nice and almost certainly boring. One afternoon, while my son was at school, I arrived to discover the infinity windows working. The room had been transformed, and I laughed out loud. Happy Mr. Pembroke explained that in the end, the problem was nothing mechanical. Inspiration at the A1 level, he said, whatever that means. It seems that the windows aren't just hybrids between two ordinary technologies, teleconferencing and digital entertainment. Some level of bottle genius was at work here. The new generation squidskins are energy frugal and startlingly realistic. But instead of piping in a scenic overlook of some great city or Martian canyon, we were being treated to a downtown corner in some cookie-cutter city. The most prosaic setting possible, which startled me as much as anything, and that's another reason why I laughed and why I kept chuckling until I was perched on top of my usual apparatus. Barry's favorite machines were occupied, which was why she happened to be riding the old warhorse on my right. "Yes, the window's working," she said, throwing her simple smile my way. "Well, good," I offered in return. It was the first time we had ever spoken. From the menu, I selected Killer Hill 3. My heart set to work with gratifying eagerness. Then I called up my library, ready to plug in 60 minutes of Ancient Greece or World War II. But I couldn't stop staring at the world stretched out before me. It felt as if we were really at ground level. Judging by the shadows, we were facing north or south. A few busy strangers walked past, people of means with bright clothes and fine, firm bodies. Some kind of tree was growing from a square of raw ground between the sidewalk and curb, and across the street stood a brick building that might have looked pretty for a couple days in its 100-year life. Like a genuine window, diluted outdoor sounds passed through the squid skin. I heard the angry motor of a truck before I saw it. Several men on my left shouted their approval, and an ancient dump truck appeared, impossibly long and carrying what looked like the marble leg and torso and battered face of an ancient statue, the statue of a naked goddess pulled from Greek mythology or adolescent fantasy. That was such an unlikely detail. Human faces are supposed to be doctored, leaving viewers unaware of who they might be watching. Privacy laws are clear on that score. But what I had heard once or twice was obviously true. The new infinity windows were as much invention as they were reality. Somewhere in the world was a city like this one, and it was inhabited by about as many pedestrians and vehicles as we saw for ourselves. But those people had different faces. And the AI, endowed with genius and the threat of boredom, was endlessly editing everything that was here, sculpting its own little storylines and odd sights, a marriage of the clever and peculiar leading to a view that people would watch, if only for fear that they might miss something remarkable. Moments later came the musical hum of a real bus. An efficient box pulled to the curb and opened up. Six or seven strangers climbed out, every face twisted to protect identities, and every one of them wore a red nose and the bright white skin of a clown. I like to think that I appreciate new technologies. Not that I'm an expert in AI genius or digital gamesmanship, but curious, endearing joy kept rolling through me. These little nuggets of fiction made me laugh, reminding me of those silly pictures that my son liked when he was five, where the game was to spot the chicken wearing a hat and the panda eating steak. Except these were stranger and much funnier visions, and to a man who wasn't going anywhere for another 45 minutes, endlessly entertaining. The biggest story was subtle. After a lull in foot traffic, a young fellow appeared. I noticed him at a distance, although I couldn't say why. Nothing about him seemed unusual. His clothes and face were ordinary. He walked toward the corner and stopped, his back to Barry and me. My assumption was that he was waiting for the next bus. Wherever this was, the day looked sunny and hot, and he stood against the building's shade. After a few moments, he turned, and with shameless intensity, he stared at my face. Then, with the same laser care, he examined Barry. And stepping back from the building, he laughed, lifting his arms and knees, and with a clown's oversized motions, pretended that he was one of us, riding a marching machine that took him nowhere. I didn't laugh so much as gasp. "He can see us," I muttered. One of Barry's doctor shows was playing. She paused it with a voice command and turned to me, never slowing her gait. But her smile changed, growing more serious. Then, with a slow, careful voice, the voice that smart people use on diminished souls, she explained, "The window works in both directions."
"It does?
Why didn't I remember that?"
"Of course it does," she said.
"One AI can serve two markets at once, which helps with energy demands and the general economics."
"But he doesn't see our faces," I said hopefully.
"Of course not,"
she gave out a big laugh, adding, "The window makes me 20 years younger, I hope." Our new friend wasn't especially young or handsome. In fact, he seemed a little disreputable. His shoes were worn out and no socks. His shirt two men's short of being a rag. He was the kind of fellow that would earn a cautious look from me if I found myself on his street. Which wouldn't happen, of course. But he or the window had a redeeming sense of humor, and his audience ended up having a good long laugh. Once the mocking workout was finished, the stranger suddenly knelt down. I didn't understand why. Then a hand that could have used a good scrub touched our club's corporate emblem, the healthy red heart and two pink lungs full of good health and happy endorphins. I cut my pace, allowing the extra oxygen to flood my foolish brain. It does make sense, though, working both ways. Barry didn't respond immediately. I just expected us to be high in the sky. It seemed important, explaining away my temporary stupidity. Windows serve many functions, she explained. Advertisement, for one. This gentleman sees spectacular versions of you and me, and he's more likely to join his local club. He doesn't look like money, I mentioned. Looks, she said with a dismissive tone. We don't know what to believe. Maybe in real life he's wearing a suit. Besides, those legs are strong, and he isn't exactly starving. No, I couldn't believe anything I was seeing. But more important, I had to be careful when I talked. An uncomfortable moment passed between us. Then this woman I didn't know turned to me. Her smile was anything but simple. With a grave, almost morbid tone, she said, "These windows bother me." "Why?" "Solipsism," she said. "Pardon?" "Do you know what the word means?" "Yes," I lied. "The premise that everything outside your own mind could be unreal." "I know the concept," I said. "Anyway," she said, "I am troubled." "By what?" She didn't answer immediately. Growing bored with the window, or at least with us, our new friend had stepped out into the sun. We watched him looking up into the branches of the little tree. I noticed the leaves, very green and shaped like fans, veins radiating out from the stem, which seemed phony. "Since I was a teenager," Barry said, "the notion that the world isn't real has been gnawing at me." "Every kid thinks that way," I said. "Everybody else is a figment of my vivid, important imagination."
"But today, anything is possible," she reminded me. "Algorithms can draw any scene, and AI wetware can string together any narrative. And everybody has to deal with that 13-year-old's conundrum. Am I real?"
"I'm real," I said reflexively.
"And how would you know?"
There wasn't any smile left on the old face. Gloomy and honest, she said,
"Maybe we're illusions. Some AI dreamed us up. We're being used as an advertisement for the health club, and the target audience is standing out there, scratching his butt."
I looked at our friend's casual ass-rubbing. "I don't believe that," I said.
"Of course you can't," she said.
And then I gave up talking, working the imaginary hill as hard as I could.
Buses are destined to run late. No system involving dozens of vehicles and thousands of humans can exclude chance, and chance wants to place every player ahead or behind schedule. That's why any two buses will usually be closer than expected or farther apart. Prospective riders face three possibilities: arrive at their stop exactly as the next bus pulls up, which gives them reason to believe in God or their special luck, or they hit an interval between two closely spaced buses, a rather more likely scenario reinforcing the idea of effective, efficient government. But the most common outcome is to enter one of the longer gaps, and if it's near the beginning, even the most rational citizen of the world will glance at the time and cluck his tongue, wondering why his goddamn bus isn't here yet. The vagaries of chance. That's what I was thinking about when I turned away from the infinity window. Apex Road was empty of buses and most other traffic, adding to the general dilapidation of downtown. I could have checked the transit logs, ringing the data for a good estimate of my departure time, but I wasn't in any special hurry. There was no place I needed to be. A joyful life full of minimal expectations. That's how I paint myself when I need to crow about my blessings. It was a warm day, but not a furnace. Not like the last 3 weeks, at least. A previous mayor used our greenhouse abatement funds to buy ginkgo trees, an enhanced strain. They were planted up and down Apex, pieces of sidewalk removed so the roots could be shoved into rectangular patches of hard clay soil. The trees thrived a few years before starting to die. Only the corner ginkgo was still alive, and there was a bench in the shade where a man could sit and wait for the next piece of his life to begin. There wasn't any wind. The world was like a picture, fixed and forever. I scratched an itch and sat down, and then I looked up. Perched on the lowest branch was a marvel. How I even noticed her is a minor mystery. Whatever the reason, I saw her perched on the ginkgo branch, and with no expectations of success, I stood up and reached high, fingers nervous until the light, dry feet shifted onto my right hand. Her size and what I remembered about mantis biology told me she was a fully mature female. All of my life I'd held a fondness for these creatures. They looked deeply unlikely, cobbled together out of several less beautiful insects, but those marvelous, murderous arms belonged to them alone. She weighed almost nothing, but she was still better than 4 inches long. I brought her down to eye level, staring at her pivoting, self-aware face. If I was a worry, she didn't show it. She held herself in a confident, queenly poise. I dropped her gently onto the back of the bench, and she accepted her new perch without complaint. I put my hands on my hips and laughed. Then I decided that an audience was necessary, which was why I looked back at the infinity window. People were still riding those elliptical beasts. The woman in front of me was tall and elegant, not young, but pretty in ways that no living, farting human being could ever manage to be. I didn't own any clothes as attractive as her tights and top. She looked like someone I should recognize. An aging actress, perhaps? In his own way, her man-friend was equally unlikely. All muscle and shiny flesh, thick veins bulging when he worked his arms, and those long, strong legs that shook the machine as he powered his way through the illusionary forward. I waved at them and pointed at my mantis, but neither person would look at me now. The man was staring off into the distance, talking with feelings about some important matter, and then he stopped talking, and the woman began to speak, causing her companion to frown and speed up even more, eyes narrowed as he contemplated whatever unwelcome news he was hearing. Once again, I looked up the street. My bus was still missing, but walking down the sidewalk was a rather pretty girl. And by girl, I mean she was a female who looked maybe 15 years younger than me, which meant she wasn't a girl at all. I watched her. She glanced at me long enough to decide that maybe she should look elsewhere. I'm accustomed to that response. I've never been a beast who dresses up in camouflage, but this was a different day, and the beast had a fresh trick at the ready. "Look here," I said. "Look at this." The girl threw a hopeful glance over her shoulder. But no, she was the only real person in sight. "I found her up in the tree," I said. My audience considered some good fast walking. "And she walked right into my hand," I concluded, backing away from the bench, palms open to the sky like a magician finishing his signature trick. It was a wonderful moment. As if playing along, the mantis did a sudden little dance, flexing her raptorial legs while that bright, watchful face did everything but wink. The girl blinked. Then she said, "Delightful," and came closer. I just stood there, grinning happily. With measured caution, she held out her hand and then slowly extended one finger, and the mantis took a swing at her fingertip. She laughed loudly, buoyantly. "Oh, it is real," she said. "I love these insects," I told her. And she gave me another look. Not that I was anything she would ever want, but there was something about my face, or my eyes, that told her that at least she didn't need to run away. The two of us could stand on that street corner talking politely. "Is it really a female?" she asked. I said that I thought so, yes. They're the bugs that chew off their lovers' heads, aren't they? While they're actually doing it. It's their nature, I said. And once again, with relish, she said. Delightful.
I'm sorry, the woman said. This was an apology, but it took me a few moments to appreciate what was happening. I slowed and looked over at Barry, and she smiled as if embarrassed, admitting, "It's a rough game, thinking you might not be real." "But I am real," she nodded politely. "I am," I repeated, but my denial was just words, reflexive and simple, and this topic made me uncomfortable. Barry looked at her machine screen, at the wise doctors and their beautiful, doomed patient. I assumed that our conversation was finished, that we might never speak again. Desperate for a distraction, I looked at the window. A young woman had just wandered into view. She could have been pretty, but she was too thin. That half-starved look that people acquire when they eat nothing but algae. Her legs and forearms were like sticks. She and that strange man chatted amiably. Then she approached the bench, her hand palm up and slow. I studied her scrawny chicken back with the spine trying to push up through the skin and the shirt. I couldn't see what her hand was doing, but I was curious, particularly when she started to laugh. A loud giggle was audible over the sounds of machines and ventilation, and that's when she turned around, showing the world what she was holding. "Look at that," I said. Barry lifted her gaze. "Is that what I think it is?" "No, it's probably something else," I said. The old woman laughed. "You're right. But it could be a praying mantis. They get that big, don't they?" "Honestly, I don't know bugs." "We could look it up," she said.
"Or we could just watch the show," I said.
The show was two strangers and that emerald green mantis perched in the girl's skeletal hand. The man said a few words, and the girl nodded and offered her other hand to the rider. More amiable than most pets, the insect walked to its new perch and flexed its arms. I could just make out its head pivoting, and the sunshine in the tree branches and how those odd, almost alien-looking leaves caught the light, turning it into something cooler and more special. For a second time, I was sad and bothered. Maybe Barry noticed, but probably not. More likely, she was just dwelling on matters that meant something to her. "I've watched a lot of these shows," she told me.
"Strangers and bugs?"
She laughed hard enough to break stride. Then she pointed at her screen, saying, "When I was little, my mother and I watched this television series, and I felt special. She allowed me to stay up late on a school night, just to see these long-dead actors reading scripts written by people I wouldn't know from anybody. Oh, and the stories they told. Contrived and melodramatic. And we loved them." This was a great bonding experience for my mother and me, and I can't stop loving them. I mean, just this scene here. This poor, gorgeous actress who lived 50 more years, but in this episode, she's dying of leukemia, and doesn't she look wonderful?
I glanced at the screen. She looks fine.
An innocent, rich, meat-fed wonderful.
I didn't know what to say.
"This is the world I was born into," Barry said, her tone amazed, even a little disbelieving. "Whatever happened to that world?"
"The future happened," I said. She laughed about that. "But we're doing better every day," I added with conviction.
The strangers were sitting on the bench. They weren't sitting together, but they were close enough that the third party in this newborn relationship could stand on one open hand and then, following some bug logic, calmly and purposefully walk across to the other offered hand. I couldn't say why, but I was fascinated. My pace slowed,
and the machine gave me a quiet warning beep. Then, as I sped up, Barry turned back to me, and with a wary eye she asked, "Do you want to know how to know if you're real or not, I mean?"
"There's a test?"
"One that I invented, yes."
"All right," I said. "Give it to me."
We sat and we talked, and I wasn't entirely sure what we had been talking about. It was that fun, that unexpected. One long, wonderful blur of words, busy and intense, but never focused on anything important. Nothing secret or even borderline personal was shared. It was just that the ordinary details of ordinary life seemed spectacularly fascinating. We discussed weather and traffic and favourite foods, and she mentioned how much she liked Chinese food. And that was my opportunity to mention that ginkgo trees were from China, and this mantis was probably the same. An Asian species was brought into the country in the last century, drafted a biological warrior in the losing war against insect pests. "So she is a weed," the girl said with amusement. "One of the monsters crumbling our precious ecosystem." "Maybe you could smash her," I suggested. And the girl gave me a funny look, trying to discern if I meant it. I didn't. Then she lifted the mantis to her face, its arms in range of her nose. The mantis's head twisted and turned, and the girl easily mimicked every motion. She wasn't beautiful, no, but there was youth and humour in her soul, and she wore the purposeful leanness of someone who didn't want to ride hard on our poor, suffering world. Lowering our friend, she looked at me, and with a suddenly serious, very important tone, she asked, "Is that your bus?" It was, but as I explained before, there was no place that I needed to be, at least not in the immediate future. "I'm going to sit here for now," I said. "Well then, I guess I will too." Such a day. And who would have guessed it possible?
"I've made a study of storytelling," Barry began. "Nothing scholarly or elaborate, but I'm lucky enough to have been around for a very long time. And what do humans do with their lives? We absorb stories. Day and night, commercial tales or twists of gossip, we swim in an ocean of story."
"You just think you're human," I said.
She laughed. "Point taken." A new bus was arriving. The shiny door swung open, but nobody disembarked. Instead of an automated pilot, there was a fat human male perched on a hard high seat. The drab uniform threatened to split with the pressure of the swollen body, fat hands clinging to the old-fashioned steering wheel. All the color was washed out of the man, but that wasn't the oddest detail. It was his face. I recognize him. To save my life, I couldn't identify the driver, but I was absolutely certain that I had seen him pictured somewhere. Maybe he was the obese man from one of my son's school lessons, a cautionary emblem of wasted, impoverishing wealth that stole too much from the world. "A good story begins in an intriguing place," Barry said. The couple remained seated on their bench, playing with the bug. The driver closed his door with a mechanical lever, and the ancient diesel engine roared as the bus rolled away, dragging a swirling black cloud of soot in its wake. "But the tale can't be too interesting either," she said. "The author doesn't dare surrender too much, because the next scenes or the coming chapters are going to drag, if only by comparison."
"I suppose not," I said.
"A great story is like a wonderful song. There are those delightful beginning notes and a fetching flow, and it builds and grows, entertaining its audience for the whole journey."
"And what does this have to do with us?" I asked.
"Stories do grow," she said. "It's inevitable, and I'm sure there is some robust scientific reason why narratives become more complicated and intricate with time.
Maybe it's because fresh characters are being introduced. Or maybe it's the thirst for surprise plots and new twists. Whatever the reason, I've seen this 1,000 times. Take My Little Doctor drama here, for instance. The television series ran for years and years, getting bigger and wilder every season. Ordinary diseases weren't good enough anymore. Plagues and spectacular tropical diseases kept raising the stakes. Happily married characters suddenly fell into torrid affairs, and the best doctors started killing patients. And every woman gave birth whenever it would help the ratings most, preferably in the middle of an anthrax attack. If she proved nothing else to me, I realized Barry was a very peculiar old gal. "So, what's your test?" I asked. "This is how you can tell if you're living inside a made-up story," she said. "If your world is contrived from thought and shaped light and a few arbitrary algorithmic principles, then odds are you are living an interesting, unlikely life. A spellbinding life. Just think of the stories that capture your imagination. Aren't they full of important coincidences and passion and tragic pain and obvious heroism? No character with a name has to wait long for something new and fascinating to happen to him." I nodded, staring straight ahead. The woman on the bench was handing the mantis to the man. The man said something, and the skinny woman smiled and said, "Yes," while nodding, closing her eyes and tilting her mouth. "Is your life fascinating?" Barry asked. "Not normally," I allowed. "Well then," she said, "every time you feel bored and ordinary, be grateful. Because that's the best evidence that you are genuinely, joyously real."
At one point I said, "You know what I want to do, don't you? I want very much to kiss you." Her name was still a mystery, and I was equally unknown to her. But bless the girl, she didn't jump up and run away. What she did was stare hard at me, never blinking, and after what seemed like a very long while, she said, "Oh, you want to kiss me, do you?" "Yes, very much," I said.
"Since when?"
she asked. I suppose she expected to hear that the idea popped into my head now, or maybe when I first saw her walking my way this way. But I surprised both of us, saying, "I woke up today wanting to. I just hadn't met you yet." It isn't often that inspiration finds me, and looking at my life, I can't think of 10 other times where this much success has come from a few words. The girl nodded and smiled, saying, "Yes." And we kissed. For a very long time, we held that pose. She even let me put a hand on her bony back and shoulder. We pulled apart and I said, "You like Chinese?" She nodded warily. "I have enough carbon points for one exceptional dinner," I promised. Hunger made her face prettier. She didn't trust herself to say yes. Her enthusiasm might scare me off, so instead she nodded and took a deep breath, handing the mantis back to me. She asked, "What does the mantis think about?" "Her next meal," I suggested. "Besides that," then the girl laughed, saying, "I think she knows that she is the center of the universe, and we're all just objects. Soulless, but entertaining to her." On that note, I stood and started to place our friend back into the tree, and that's when I looked at the infinity window again. I suppose I wanted to see approval from our audience. But the window had gone out. And except for a giant gutted room and some upturned office furniture, there was nothing to see. There was nothing but glass and the girl's reflection, and mine, and my arm up high, as if I was waiting for some hook or hand to grab me up and carry me away.
We hollered. I think every patron in the club yelled loudly, and most of the words angry. Mr. Pembroke came bounding out of his office. He is a red-faced man with no hair and elastic kangaroo-style legs.
Sharing our panic, he began chasing wires and tinkering with diagnostic boards. Within the first few minutes, he narrowed the blame down to the 10 or 20 possibilities, none of which he could fix. His apologies were earnest, and he wished there was more that he could do. But there wouldn't be any fix until tomorrow, if then, and with that sorry bit of non-news, he bounded back to his office and vanished. I was still beside Barry, still working my lungs and heart. I had watched those strangers start to kiss, and now I was staring at the white wall, some piece of me ready for whatever scene was to come next. And I kept thinking about that long green mantis, too. Barry and I exchanged a few more words. She was still attacking the easy miles when I finished, and I thanked her for the conversation. "Food for thought," I said. Then I called for help, and my personal cradle swept in and took me under what remains of my arms, lifting me up as my new friend said, "I'll see you around, perhaps." "I'm sure you will," I said. There was something else I wanted to say, but I resisted. I didn't think it would be right, parting on a sour, disagreeable note. I live 10 floors below the club in an apartment that encompasses an enormous volume, a wealthy man's home with 2 rooms and a private, water-free bath. I really don't have the means for this luxury, which is why the rest of my life is full of sacrifices. I rarely run the air conditioning and never travel. It takes very little food to keep my minimal body alive and healthy, which gives me extra carbon points. In this world with too many people and too many problems, my son eats well when he comes home. And on that day, it seemed like such a blessing to see him. A robust and busy, full-limbed gentleman who was 5 days short of his 13th birthday. His dinner was real potatoes and peas and a meat that was sold under the euphemistic label rabbit. I had an intravenous meal and chew stick to keep my mouth busy. Together we watched what interested me, the world's news compressed into 14 minutes of drought and distant wars, plus heaping helpings of heroic perseverance and robots exploring the high clouds of Venus. Then I let him choose for both of us, and I endured the animated fluff. I watched my boy. I smiled at him, at least until he noticed. Then he frowned like any near adolescent, telling me, "Stop that!" I looked away, staring at the emptiest of our walls. I was imagining the would-be lovers, wondering what part of them was real, and then I pictured Barry beside me, and I told her, "This is where you are wrong. Characters in a story can't tell if anything about their lives is remarkable or interesting. They just are. But there is one major difference between stories and life. Stories come to an end. Eventually and always, there is a last chapter, a final scene. As you said, fictions get too big and cumbersome, and then the author gives them a mercy killing. But real life goes on and on. And that's how you know that all of this is genuine." My boy noticed something in my gaze, or maybe I was muttering to myself. "What are you thinking about, Dad?" "Nothing, son. Nothing."